My name is Jack Nelson Pallmeyer. For those of you who don't know, I'm on staff here this summer, one of the summer program coordinators, and will be here with my wife, Sarah, who was giving the announcements this morning, until September. And my background is in political science and also theology, and a lot of my thoughts about the Bible lately have to do with being rooted in some of the issues of Central America, where my wife and I lived for a couple of years. We're not going to look at just one passage today. We're going to kind of do a biblical survey of a number of different issues. But to start out, I just wanted to have us talk a little bit about what do you think of when you hear the term dominant culture? What does dominant culture mean for you? What are some of the images you have?
Noise from TV and radio.
Noise from TV and radio.
Contrast from here.
That is a contrast from here. Others? White. What do you think of when you hear dominant culture?
White.
Okay, white.
High tech.
High tech.
Affluence.
Sports.
Sports.
Military.
Military. What was the other one? There were two were said at one time. Military and?
Peer pressure.
Peer pressure.
Government.
Anybody else?
Majority.
Majority.
USA.
Okay. USA, dominant culture. Okay. Christians had an interesting way of posing this problem, or a simple way of responding to the problem of assimilation into a dominant culture. And what they said was, Christ is Lord, or Jesus is Lord. And in that simple statement was a statement of ultimate allegiance. And I think it implies a view of the dominant culture as being a danger. That assimilation into a dominant culture would be a danger. How do the Ten Commandments start out?
I am the Lord your God.
I am the Lord your God.
You shall have no other gods.
If we look at that in Deuteronomy 5:6. So someone would just read it. Deuteronomy 5, verse 6.
I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage.
I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. Now, why was that remembrance so important? Why is that preface to the Ten Commandments so important?
Identification
in terms of what?
Of the people.
Of the people. And what do they identify themselves with?
It's the people that were in bondage in Egypt, and the Lord brought them out. And so they're identified as the people who were in bondage in the Lord.
So it brings to their minds that memory of slavery. And it brings to their minds that memory of a God who lifted them out of that slavery. Is that right? Okay. Now why? You can imagine that would be important as the people are about to enter the land. They remember that. And in that sense, it's almost kind of a warning. It's like, remember who you are as a people as you're about to enter the land, which is a whole different situation than being slaves or being in a wilderness. But why might that memory be important years and years and years later?
Well, they don't repeat that problem with another group. Enslave somebody.
So they wouldn't become the oppressors. Also think about in the context of a totally radically changed situation. For example, when the people of Israel lost their land. And they went into exile. Or think of the situation of people in Latin America today, or in Central America today, who are living in the midst of a tremendous amount of repression, a lot of governmental power over them, economic resources in the hands of a few. Or think of the situation of black slaves during the time of slavery. Why might this sentence be important to them?
Gives them hope.
So that in the memory of that is the promise of a future. Mm-hmm. Okay. Why is it that assimilation into a dominant culture is dangerous? Why would that be dangerous? And what are some examples? As you think about the Christian community that you're a part of, the church that you're a part of, the denomination that you're a part of, have you, in your experience, are you avoiding, think of your own life as a Christian, are you avoiding assimilation in the dominant culture? Is there a fierce independence there? Or in what ways have we assimilated?
There's a tendency amongst the Scandinavians to draw apart in a different way, not to be assimilated either by what the church is about or by the dominant culture.
So it can almost be a turning inward. That can be a danger. How about others? What are some of the dangers of...
Are you losing your identity?
Can you give some specific examples of losing your identity? What would you mean by that?
Well, the Hebrews not remembering who they were and that they were people of the Exodus.
Okay, but how about in your own experience now? In the experience looking at the church in the context of the USA. Have we assimilated? Or Christians in the context of the USA? In what ways have we assimilated?
Not being able to recognize the values that we've been given from God and by which we are called to live, and instead adapting to the values and mores of the culture around us.
Okay, so losing track of our values. Can you give a specific example?
Money. Money over service.
Good.
A simple one that comes to mind for me is working on Sunday, which keeping one day as a holy day, which is hard to do anymore.
Uh-huh. So Sunday, rather than being a day of worship and reflection and maybe searching. Uh-huh.
Materialism, wanting consumerism, falling into the pattern of wanting to buy as much as we can get.
So consumerism and materialism is a way of assimilating and losing some of those values and identity. Others?
The loss of community in favor of individualism.
Okay, the loss of community in favor of individualism.
Forgetting that Jesus is Lord, substituting his lordship with the lordship of militarism. That the bomb is what is our protector, bowing down to the government.
Okay, so substituting the lordship of Jesus with, you were saying, suggesting the lordship of militarism. Mm-hmm. Others?
Forms of racism.
Okay, various forms of racism.
We really do think that power is how we get what we want, no matter where on the political spectrum we light. We use interests to use power and overwhelm the problem.
So the question of power becomes an important one in terms of... It's always been interesting to me how we reconcile across with power.
Well, I think in that light, too, the issue of violence versus nonviolence in terms of the concept of peaceful change versus we have a sense that the only way you get change through power is using that power in violence rather than seeing the power in nonviolence.
Okay. So the question of violence and nonviolence. Anybody else thinking about your own church and your own Christian community?
I think convenience and comfort are God's others. And anything that improves on that is real upsetting.
How many pastors do we have in the room? Just out of curiosity. A number. What kind of pressures do you feel as pastors from your congregation? I sometimes talk about one of the big dangers we face in the United States is what I call self-censorship of the church, or self-censorship of the press, for that matter. What kind of pressures do you as pastors feel? Do you know the line that you can go, the things you can and cannot say, and how is that? Do you feel those kind of pressures, or if you just say it, I don't care about those things, I'm going to be faithful? How do you deal with those pressures?
Well, I'm an interim pastor, so I don't have to worry about that.
Anybody else? Yeah.
I have a feeling, looking at the culture, that the Sunday morning worship has been, in an American culture, now I know this is extreme, is based on the Super Bowl or the Professional Football League. And I feel the 8:30 service was designed to make sure everybody could get to the 11 o'clock game. I guess I'm an 11 o'clock man. But I think Sunday has been taken by a worship of a spectator sport to a great degree. It almost becomes an obscenity if we're not careful. And I don't want to put down
right.
People in it.
But it's an accommodation. You're saying it's an accommodation to the broader culture, the church agenda, trying to fit in neatly with the. Okay. Well, go ahead. Yeah. And then we got two more here. Go ahead.
It seems to me that one of the biggest things that has been a botheration for me is the fact that so many American Christians are Lutheran. Do not accept the cross of Christ, that we have imbibed almost totally the American dream of the American way of life, and which ultimately becomes the theology of the cross.
So you're saying that within the framework of the culture, the cross basically gets ignored. The cost of discipleship gets obscured. Okay, yeah, you had your hand.
The thing that I see in that we have to fight against and think about is the fact that we have one natural law that pervades over everything if we look at it in proper context. And that's the law of osmosis, and that's the tendency to dilute. You're talking about your strong points. Osmosis is nothing more than a passage from the lower to the higher concentration. Everything in nature, everything in life has a tendency to dilute and make an amalgamation of everything. Therefore, it's hard to keep them all in peace.
Anybody else? Yeah, Chuck.
Yeah, two things quickly. The congregation I belong to for the last couple decades has set its annual meeting in January on a Sunday that would avoid Super Bowl, which follows up what was said back there. But I guess more seriously, there's a kind of concern in U.S. religious life about Lutheranism and its distinctiveness being absorbed within a kind of general U.S. Protestant mainline tradition. And it often comes out in terms of a theology of glory or success versus a theology of the cross.
Uh-huh.
I just thought of that when you were talking about the theology of the cross. I think the other problem for Lutherans is to remain so distinctive and so separate that they never become ecumenical.
But right, which was the point of the woman back there. Okay, well, I want to just examine a couple of the dangers from a biblical perspective by looking at a couple of passages. And one of those dangers has to do with economics and specifically land. That from the biblical perspective, land was seen as a gift from God, and the users of the land were seen as stewards of that gift. So that the productive resource as well as the product that was produced became an area for Christian stewardship or biblical stewardship. So let's just look, if we look up Leviticus 25, and if someone would read verses 23 and 24. Leviticus 25, 23 and 24.
The land shall not be sold in perpetuity, for the land is mine. If you are strangers and sojourners, for you are strangers and sojourners with me, and in all the country you possess, you shall grant the redemption of the land.
Okay, so you should not sell the land forever because the land belongs to God. And then if someone would read verses 10 through 12, Leviticus 25, verses 10 through 12.
And you shall hallow the 50th year and proclaim liberty throughout the land to all its inhabitants. It shall be a jubilee for you, when each of you shall return to his property and each of you shall return to his family. A jubilee shall that 50th year be to you. In it you shall neither sow nor reap what grows of itself, nor gather the grapes from the undressed vines, for it is a jubilee. It shall be holy to you, and you shall eat what it yields out of the field.
So one of the grave dangers seen by the people as they were about to enter the land was that land which was to be a gift from God, and therefore they laid out a provision, the Jubilee, that every 50 years land would be redistributed so that you would avoid the problem of tremendous inequality in that precious wealth-producing resource. That when they entered the land, the danger was that assimilation to a more dominant culture could mean the loss of an identity between the land and God, and that land would simply become a commodity to be used by the most powerful. And let's look at a couple of passages. If one volunteer would just look up Isaiah 5, verse 8. Someone raise their hand and be willing to do that. Isaiah 5, 8, somebody. Okay, right here. And then if someone else would look up Isaiah 3, verses 12b, or the middle of verse 12 through 15. Someone willing to do that? Raise a hand. Isaiah 3, verses 12b through 15. Will you do that one? Okay. And then if someone would look up Amos 8, 4 through 7. I'm going to raise a hand on that one. Amos 8, verses 4 through 7. Okay. So, these are, very quickly, examples of basically betrayal of the community value in favor of assimilating into a more dominant culture. And would you read then Isaiah 5, verse 8?
Only those who join house to house, who add field to field, until there is no more room, and you are made to dwell alone in the midst of the land.
Okay, woe to woe that add house and house and field to field. Okay, Isaiah 3, verses 12b through 15.
O my people, your leaders mislead you and confuse the course of your path. The Lord has taken his place to contend. He stands to judge his people. The Lord enters into judgment with the elders and princes of his people. It is you who have devoured the vineyard. The spoil of the poor is in your houses. What do you mean by crushing my people, by grinding the face of the poor, says the Lord God of hosts?
You can begin to see with the reading of that passage, I can't remember who it was who pointed out, that one of the reasons to remember that phrase, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, was so that they didn't turn around and become oppressors of others. And that's what we see happening. Okay, and then Amos 8, 4 through 7.
Hear this, you who trample upon the needy and bring the poor of the land to an end, saying, when will the new moon be over that we may sell grain, and the Sabbath that we may offer wheat for sale, that we may make the ephah, something small, and the shekel great, and deal deceitfully with false balances? What, 4 and 5?
4 through 7.
That we may buy the poor for silver and the needy for a pair of sandals and sell the refuse of the wheat. The Lord has sworn by the pride of Jacob, surely I will never forget any of their deeds. Shall not the land tremble on this account, and everyone mourn who dwells in it, and all that rise like the Nile and be tossed about and sink again like the Nile of Egypt?
That's fine. Okay, what was happening in the time of Amos is that basically urban dwellers, along with grain merchants, began to acquire more and more power. And these grain merchants are very upset that there's a festival day in which they can't sell their grain. And basically what was happening, and archaeological excavations bear this out, is that there was within the city one section with large, beautiful palaces and big houses, and these same people apparently had their second homes in the countryside and were taking control of more and more land, while at the same time, the majority of people lived in little, tiny structures, obviously in great poverty, and Amos condemned this. Let's look at Luke 4, 18 through 19. Because although many, many years obviously passed between Isaiah and Amos and the time of Jesus, we get a sense for the kind of world that Jesus entered into and how it was that Jesus defined his ministry. So if you look at Luke 4, verses 18 and 19. Someone willing to read that?
The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he has anointed me to preach good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim release to the captives and recovering of sight to the blind, to set at liberty those who are oppressed, to proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord.
Okay, this is from the chronology of Luke. This is the first sermon of Luke in which Jesus is announcing the form that his ministry is going to take. Now, we can look at this, but without looking, does anybody remember what story precedes this in Luke 4? No, go ahead. Anybody. Okay, it's the story of the temptation narrative. And what was the temptation narrative? What were the three temptations that Jesus was faced with during his 40 days and 40 nights in the desert? Let's list them. What was one of them?
Stones into bread.
Okay. Turn stones into bread. What was another?
Jump off the temple.
Okay. Jump off the pinnacle of the temple and have angels come down and save you. What was the other one?
Kiss the devil's
idolatry.
Okay, the idolatry basically of nationalism, of being the leader of the nations. Now, what's interesting is that when the Messiah, when the rumor of the Messiah was coming, which had gone on for many, many, there have been many, many rumors of the Messiah coming, these three images capture a lot of what that messianic expectation was. One very common notion was that a Messiah would come as a political leader that would restore Israel to its place of prominence within history. Jesus seems, in this temptation narrative, to reject that option. Another very common tendency, and I would say this is our tendency as well many times, is we want a God who's going to come, we want a Jesus, or who has come, that's going to say, "All right, Jesus, you solve all the problems. Turn these stones into bread. Be the miracle worker that can cut ourselves out of it. We don't have to change. We don't have to be converted. We don't have to have our lives and communities transformed. We'll let you do it, Jesus. You turn these stones into bread." That was another major temptation. And, of course, another temptation I think that's symbolized in the leaping off the pinnacle of the temple was, what better way to establish your religious credibility than by jumping off of the temple and having an angel come and pick you up? Now, Jesus seems to have rejected all of those, and then he defines his ministry. And how would you describe his ministry in Luke 4:18 and 19? Suffering servant. With some pretty clear priorities of where that ministry is going to be rooted.
And a surprising reversal. not the expected conventional way.
So he's going to hang out and become an advocate for losers.
Right.
For the most part. Prisoners, political and otherwise. People who have been run over with chariots. People who were victims in sword battles, you know, not victors. I mean, you know, he's going to tend to the wounded.
So he's throwing himself in with...
He's throwing himself in with a bunch of losers.
And look at verse 19. It says, to proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord. Now, it's very likely that what Jesus is doing here is defining his ministry in terms of jubilee. Now, I think if we take this seriously, one of the things that we can begin to understand is why Jesus was crucified. One of the ways in which it seems to me that we've assimilated the biblical word into our culture is that we've lost track of what Will and Chuck just suggested, and that is, it's a surprising turnaround, and where Jesus decided to throw his lot into with the outcasts, the people who had been run over by chariots, and also that he seems here to be declaring a land reform. Well, obviously, there's a lot of people who would like to hear about a land reform, but not the power brokers of society. So one of the, it seems to me, if we're to disengage ourselves from being assimilated in the culture, one of the things we need to recognize is that Jesus was crucified as a consequence of the ministry that he lived out, as a consequence of his life, by rejecting those traditional notions and by putting his lot in a certain place. Okay, let's look at a second issue, and this one was mentioned earlier, that was one of the big dangers in terms of assimilation, and that's the issue of lifestyle. Look up Exodus 16, verses 17 through 21. Now later in the week, on Thursday, I think I'm doing another Bible study. I'm going to try to focus more in on economics and the biblical message. So I'm not going to go into a lot of detail here, but just to touch on a couple of issues that seems to me to lay out a groundwork as we think about Christian faith, again, up against the dominant culture. Okay, this is the story of the manna. And would someone read Exodus 16, verses 17 through 21?
And the people of Israel did so. They gathered some more, some less. But when they measured it with an omer, he that gathered much had nothing over, and he that gathered little had no lack. Each gathered according to what he could eat. And Moses said to them, let no man leave any of it till the morning. But they did not listen to Moses. Some left part of it till the morning, and it bred worms and became foul. And Moses was angry with them. Morning by morning they gathered it, each as much as he could eat. But when the sun grew hot, it melted.
What do you think what's suggested by that story?
I know. Give us this day our daily bread.
Exactly. The New Testament. What do we pray every day? Enough is enough.
It also suggests the U.S. overuse of food while other people are going hungry. Yeah. We're gathering each one for as much as we can eat.
Rich?
I think it tells us to live adequately and not excessively.
Okay, let's look at Amos 6. Someone look up Amos 6, verses 4 through 6. Yeah, they are.
You go back to confirmation, man, and you go.
Yeah, there it is.
Yeah.
Okay, Amos 6, 4 through 6, page 794.
That's the way that...
That bails us out.
It's a non-Lutheran way of doing it.
That's right. We Lutherans generally like to make people feel guilty, so if they can't find it, you know, then they're, well, I guess I better really go back and... But we'll tell you the page number, because we're not into that here. So someone wanted to read that, verses 4 through 6.
Woe to those who lie upon beds of ivory and stretch themselves upon their couches and eat lambs from the flock and calves from the midst of the stall, who sing idle songs to the sound of the harp and like David invent for themselves instruments of music, who drink wine in bowls and anoint themselves with the finest oils, but are not grieved over the ruin of Joseph.
Pretty stark contrast in terms of the, the sufficiency of the manna and then the gluttony. There's a great exchange here, and if someone wants, you can come up to me afterwards and I'll give you the verses, but there's a great exchange in the book of Amos between the prophet and the wealthy of Israel, in which Amos begins to condemn their wealth and the society of exploitation on which that wealth was based. That's verse 1. And in the next verse, the wealthy come back and they say to Amos, "But Amos, look out over all the other kingdoms that we can see from here." And he rattles off a list of nations. "Aren't we greater and more powerful and more affluent than they?" And then it comes back, Amos responds, "You're missing the point, that that wealth is not a vindication, is not a sign of God's blessing. You're missing the point that so much of that wealth is based on the exploitation." But it's an incredible exchange, it seems to me, for our time as we think about our role within a dominant culture. Because the dominant culture says to us that when we work hard, we're rewarded, that we earn things, etc. Okay. So far, to summarize what I've been trying to suggest here, is that there are a number of characteristics of the biblical community or the Christian community that maybe can help us as we think about our relationship to a dominant culture. One of those is that to remember that phrase that "I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt," and seeing in that a call for us to be participants in liberation within history, that we become instruments of liberation rather than domination. The second would be the idea that we look at economics in terms of not only economic sharing, but also a wide distribution of productive resources, as in the case of a jubilee of a land reform, which again, remember the importance of land. Third, that somehow how lifestyle should stress sufficiency, and that our meaning is not to be found through consumption, but through service and through our participation in the community. And then finally, that we need to be a people with a memory and also a people of promise. Again, it's amazing to me when we think, and one of the things that we're going to have a chance to wrestle with in the next couple of weeks and to learn from and be filled by is the diversity of the experiences, and out of the black experience, the amazing resiliency and the ability to survive slavery, or from the people of Latin America, the incredible somehow ability to stay rooted in faith amidst incredible repression in a place like El Salvador, for example, that comes out of this memory of a people and being a people of the promise. Okay, one other passage I want us to look at, and that is Luke 10, 25 through 37. And this is going to build off of Will's sermon last night. Luke 10, we won't read this all. It's a story that's familiar to most of us. Luke 10, 25 through 37. It's the parable of the Good Samaritan, or I think more aptly put, the parable of the compassionate Samaritan. It's not really a parable about being good or bad. It's a question about what enables us to be compassionate or what blocks compassion. But remember the story, there's a victim who's left by the roadside, half dead. The priest and the Levite cross by on the other side. And a Samaritan comes by, takes care of the needs of the person. And there was a lawyer who asked the question of Jesus, who's my neighbor, trying to justify himself, and doesn't really get the answer that he was looking for. In fact, he's so shocked at the example that Jesus gave about a Samaritan being the good person in the story who shows compassion, that when Jesus at the end of this parable asked the lawyer, who was it who proved neighbor to, all he could say is, well, the one who had compassion. He couldn't even get himself to say Samaritan, right? Okay. Well, as we look at this parable, what are some lessons that we might learn as we think about this week coming up, this week of the rainbow on the mountain? Who was the victim in this story? What do we know about the victim?
Nothing.
We know nothing about the victim. We don't know if the victim is white or black or red or brown or yellow, Muslim or Christian, what country. All we know is that there is a victim, an unjust victim, and somehow they are our neighbors. But the story goes further. Will's sermon last night was very provocative, it seemed to me, in which he was talking about exclusiveness, and that maybe Jesus would go on at some point and say, don't go to the Samaritans now because we're not ready for it. Well, in fact, we have in this story, and we have in other stories, which was obviously a great shock to the people whom Jesus was telling and working with, the use of a Samaritan. And I think that is a sign to me that one, again, of the characteristics of the Christian community is that we need to be an inclusive, racially diverse, multi-ethnic, cultural community of people. And I think that this week offers us an opportunity to discover some of the richness of that diversity. Yeah.
When the story of the Good Samaritan is told, not as the way Jesus told it, or the way he intended for it to be told later on, I mean, guessing that he might have guessed that he had hit a hot one here, and that people would remember it, somebody would write it down. It is a hot story, but most people, church people, miss the point. And not only the point where the victim is not identified, which is, there's all kinds of gold in that one, but what is the point of the story? Why did he tell it in the first place? Who was it who needed help? Well, couldn't be the victim because it's a story, so the victim is not real. I mean, he's a for instance. Well, it's the guy who had the legal education and who had money, resources, power, and all of that. I think he was the person who needed help. And Jesus recognized that, and so often when he ran into people whom he knew needed help, but whom he felt they did not need any help, he'd start with a kind of a put-on. Well, let me tell you a story. And then he'd go on and on and on with the storytelling and make his point and then be fully expecting somebody to miss it. Well, the point of the story of the compassionate Samaritan is not to gather up a whole lot of love and run around being always ready to lay it on somebody. That's the way we start out in Sunday school. The point of the story, obviously, is to love Jesus. And to be, be accepting, of the full consequences of getting his help. So it wasn't, the people who went by, the priests and the Levites, very interesting that he picked on, hierarchical church forms, huh? those people who went by, it wasn't that they refused to help the guy in the ditch, but they refused to be helped. That's an interesting twist, isn't it? That the suffering and the outcast, the dispossessed of the earth, can help you. I think about that every time I happen to run across Shuler's television program. I can't lose because I don't hang out with losers. I don't need any help. you know, from losers. Give me winners. Well, you see, the winners don't think that they need help. And I think that that was the point of the story, which is why Jesus put the priest, I guess, and the Levite,
right,
into the story also.
And the lawyer.
And the lawyer, all three of them. You know, one and the same. So the lawyer should identify more, not with the compassionate one, but with
the victim.
Yeah.
You know, the very, very similar point that was striking for me is a very similar story when a rich young man comes to Jesus and says, "What do I have to do to inherit eternal life?"
Put on, yeah.
And in the Gospel of Mark, it's prefaced before Jesus says to this person, "Go sell all you have and give it to the poor." Mark prefaces it with the words, "And Jesus looked upon the young man and loved him."
Yeah.
And loved him and told him, "Go sell what you have." Again, similar message.
That's the same question here, though. That's the same question that generates the story of the Good Samaritan. Mm-hmm. In fact, the story responds. It's a double question. He asks, "What do you have to do?" And it says, "You love your neighbor as yourself." Well, who's your neighbor? And then he tells that. And then at the end, he says, "You know, go and do likewise," which is a response to the initial question. That the person was asking in the first place of inheriting eternal life.
Mm-hmm. What's intriguing to me here is that I think this is the beginning of Jesus' ministry where he makes it humanly possible to be Jewish. Up until that time, it's a hierarchical function, it's a historical context, it's getting yourself in line. And he's literally saying your relationship to others is your relationship to God. Now, that opens up a universe on a horizontal plane that if we would rotate the axis would be pretty tall. And it's an unending eternity of options that is the more abundant life. And I think what we're really looking at here is an interesting case when we get into the rainbow situation, because, you know, if we don't get the right mix, are you Christian? You win extra points by being compassionate to somebody who is a social reject.
Yeah.
And that's the liberal position. And what's really interesting there is that the lowliest, as well as the mightiest, can be a meaningful relationship. And what we were arguing last night, I had a case where you don't have to convert people. You can be Christian to non-Christians. That's the true witness. And thereby your relationship to them fulfills your obligation as a Christian. Doesn't necessarily make them one of the gang. And maintaining that outreach, I think, is the exciting thing, because prior to that time, you had to get in line. You had to join the group, you had to be in order, you had to clean the house, you stoned anybody who wasn't in order. And you began a whole purge, clean, donatus controversy that made a beautiful church. And Jesus is essentially saying, "Hey, I can rebuild this any day."
Yeah, I think the point to remember, though, is not just that form of doing it right was prevalent then. It's what we always fall into when we refuse to listen to the gospel. We always would prefer to do it right. Then it becomes very, it's almost within our reach.
No risk.
To be righteous by ourselves.
But in terms of our dominant culture, why I raise that point is that we tend to associate humanism with Greeks. And they are not humanistic at all. They're after heroes. So it really says that it's humanly possible to be fulfilled as you are in terms of your relationship to others. Well, that's fundamental. That's terribly threatening to power and authority. And when we get to Jesus' death, we can bring in the Romans.
Anybody else? Any other comments about these or previous points that we've been talking about?
The other reference that certainly is condemning is the parable of the Lazarus and the rich man, too. Really drives home and hits you very hard every time you deal with that.
But that separation.
As these others.
And I think we need to, you know, one of the things about the parable of the Compassionate Samaritan too for me is that crossing over to the other side is really can be a metaphor, and we can think about all the ways that we cross over to the other side, from building suburbs to separate ourselves from others, to ideology that writes people off as communists, to all kinds of things, and that part of our task is to enter life. Well, any other comment? I would like to close this session with a quote, I think appropriately, from Martin Luther King, that also, for me, stresses another essential aspect or part of our Christian identity as we think about the dominant culture. And that's a hope that is deeply rooted enough that we're willing to take risks. Because getting back again to some of the costs of discipleship. Again, Jesus was crucified as a consequence of his life. That's probably a road that we have to seriously consider ourselves. And I think this quote from Dr. King summarizes that well for me. I have to say, I read this even more seriously because I happen to be the age of the person. I just turned 36 not long ago. And Dr. King says, "If a man or a woman happens to be 36 years old, as I happen to be, and some great truth stands before the door of their life, some great opportunity to stand up for that which is right and that which is just, and they refuse to stand up because they want to live a little longer, and they are afraid that their home might get bombed, or they are afraid that they will get shot, they may go on and live until they are 80, and the cessation of breath in their life is merely the belated announcement of an earlier death of the spirit." For me, that's a powerful thing to think about, that the death that we are to fear is not the cessation of our life at the end of our time, but a dying in the midst of life. And I think for me, if we assimilate into the dominant culture too much and we lose our identity, that is the biblical understanding of death. And so that this is a powerful plea for us to live in hope, and that hope needs to carry us at times into dangerous places. Any other comment before we break? Yeah, one of the things that strikes me as I read the New Testament is how much people gave up to follow Jesus, and yet how much they apparently received in doing so. And I think that's one of the powerful messages about Christian community, is that somehow we are able to do things that individually we could not do, and that we're able to do that oftentimes with a spirit of renewal and hope that we think impossible as we look at a dangerous situation. Okay, well, I would like to thank everybody for their participation and enjoy the rest of the morning.